Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Welcome to another classic replay from the archives of Unbelievable. Today, from February 2015, Joshua Ryan Butler, author of The Skeletons in God's Closet, discussed hell, judgment, and holy war with Jeff Cook. They debated whether Old Testament warfare passages constitute divinely mandated genocide.
Well, today on the programme, we're discussing The Skeletons in God's Closet, The Mercy of Hell, The Surprise of Judgment, and The Hope of Holy War. Two special guests join me, Josh Butler and Jeff Cook, and the title of Skeletons in God's Closet, well, that's the title of a new book by Josh Butler. He says, we'll pull these bones out into the open to exchange popular caricatures for the beauty and power of the real thing. We'll discover these topics were never really skeletons at all, but proclamations of a God who is good in his very bones, not just in what he does, but in who he is. We'll fling wide the closet door and sing loudly, boldly and clearly, God is good and coming to redeem his world. So he tackles in The Skeletons in God's Closet these three issues of hell, judgment and holy war. In conversation with Josh today is Jeff Cook. He's a theologian, former guest on the show. Doesn't agree entirely with Josh's take on every aspect in the book. So we're going to have an interesting discussion, I think, today. And we're going to begin with talking about what Jeff calls divinely mandated genocide. Now, if you're interested, there's a recent article in the magazine I edit, Premier Christianity Magazine, dealing with the issue of Did God Command Genocide, written by Peter J. Williams of Tyndale House in Cambridge. You can get that. It's available on the website. You can get a free sample copy of the magazine for yourself, premierchristianity.com. But we're going to be exploring Josh's take on this along with Jeff today on the programme. So a very good afternoon to you both, gentlemen.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
It's great to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on too, Jeff. Josh, let's start with you. We want to hear first a little bit about you. You're a church leader, I understand. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your own faith and what led you to write this particular book?
Yeah, definitely. So, I'm a pastor out here in Portland, Oregon, out in the U.S. I have a wife, three children, three young kids. One is foster, we're kind of adopting right now. And I oversee in our church, particularly a focus on our local ministries here in Portland and then our international partnerships overseas. And a lot of the heart behind the book was just going, these are questions that I wrestled with in my own faith over the years. And I just found so many people in our church that, were kind of processing and grappling with these questions. Things like hell, judgment, holy war, kind of going, how do I reconcile that with the goodness of God and kind of my understanding of kind of the outrageous love of Christ displayed on the cross. So seeing that in our own church as well as in our city, lots of folks grappling with those questions and really wanting to help resource folks. And I think that for me over the years, I had some paradigm shifts in my own life where, I think for a lot of us, we fear that God's kind of hiding these skeletons. There's these tough topics of the faith that if we were to really open up the closet doors, if we were to open up our Bibles and take a close look, I think the fear is that we'd find that God is not really good or worthy of our trust. But I think that's often because we have a caricature of what's actually going on in the story. So my hope was to kind of confront some of those popular caricatures and offer, share some of the paradigm shifts that I found really helpful in a way where we see these topics arising because of the goodness of God rather than in spite outside of or in contradiction to it. So my big end game, I think my big hope at the end of the day was to help us kind of reclaim a more robust confidence in the goodness of God.
Is this a topic that has come more into people's minds and your church members' minds and so on, because it tends to get lobbed as a criticism of God by skeptics online, especially? I can barely have a conversation with an atheist skeptic online without at some point these kinds of issues coming into the fray. So is that particularly why you think it's relevant at the moment?
Definitely, yeah. And you know, even in my own experience, like, these are questions I wrestled with, say, on the kind of the holy war, the Old Testament violence one. I spent about 6 months at an internship working on the Navajo reservation here in the U.S. It's a kind of Native American reservation here, and seeing some of the ways that in my own country's history, in U.S. history, we had used kind of, you know, stories, texts of Israel's kind of conquest of Canaan to justify mistreatment and justice, I would say, against Native American peoples here on our soil. And I really became kind of just disillusioned with going, wow, what is going on in the Bible? Is that just a kind of an ancient version of this modern injustice that we see today? And so even my own life kind of grappling with how do I reconcile that with God? But as I dove into scripture and in that area and others, suddenly pretty quickly finding not only is something radically different, I think, happening here, it actually seems to be something that critiques, say in that example, critiques my country's history with Native peoples. It would actually confront us in many ways, and so and in ways that I found actually pretty beautiful in terms of who God is. So yeah, so there's definitely a cultural context, and as well as even just, you know, personally trying to dig deeper into scripture.
Well, it's great to have you on the program, Josh, and we're gonna start once we get the conversation going with the issue of holy war. What some people, as I say, like to term genocide, though I don't know whether that's the term you'd be happy to kind of put on it in your book. But we'll come to all that in a moment's time. Thanks for being with us on the program today. Jeff is also with us. Jeff Cook, who's a former guest on the program. He's in church leadership himself. And Jeff, last time you joined me on the program, which was a couple of years ago now, you were sort of talking about your own book at the time, which kind of charts to some extent the fact that you kind of had a crisis of faith yourself, and kind of about how you rebuilt your faith, as it were, from the ground up. Tell me about, you got in touch with me about this book. Tell me what sparked your interest in looking at these issues at this point.
I really enjoyed Josh's book. I love his tone. I think that he is addressing problems that need to be spoken about. I loved that he wrestled with hell in a way that hasn't been wrestled with from those who defend more of a traditional view of hell. He was really pushing into, here's why hell itself is praiseworthy, or it is a solution that God might foresee and advocate. Those are things that I've wanted to hear from folks on the traditional side. And I really did enjoy the book. I thought it was worthy of having a conversation over.
I mean, you've certainly wrestled yourself with these issues, haven't you, over the years? Do you feel like you kind of got to a point where you've got a particular view on hell and judgment and some of those Old Testament passages on warfare that you can live with? Or is there still a certain amount of, I'm not sure what I believe or what's going on with some of those?
Yeah, on hell, I come down on the annihilationist side. I wrote a book, the book I wrote a while back, Everything New. It seems to me the annihilationist picture of hell actually has a lot of value in God's solution of eliminating evil. In terms of divinely mandated genocide, this is something I don't know what to do with. I think a lot of Christians are probably in that spot. We hear the language used in the Old Testament, and we have a very difficult time imagining that the things being put into the mouth of God would actually be spoken by Jesus Christ. And so I'm looking for answers on that. I would love to see the Bible as inspired and fully, you know, beautiful in everything that it communicates. And obviously, when, like many, when I get to those passages, I have a really difficult time wrestling through them myself.
Okay, well, it should be an interesting conversation anyway, to start to look into these issues. And if you're listening and you'd like to have your say as well, well, why not to set it down in an email to me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, to email me. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show, of course, to recent programmes as well. You can find us online at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Today's show is there. You can leave your comments under it. You can also click through to the Facebook and Twitter accounts at unbelievablejb for Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb on the Facebook page. So we're discussing The Skeletons in God's Closet today. That's the title of the new book by Josh Butler, looking at hell, judgment and holy war. Big issues, certainly sort of not something that we can do thoroughly in the course of today's programme, but at least we'll get a sense of where Josh is coming from and where Jeff is coming from on some of these issues. So that's the topic of today's programme here on the show that aims to get you thinking.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, maybe the way to start off our conversation then is, Jeff, for you to pitch the problem of what you call divinely mandated genocide. And we're talking here, I guess, about those troublesome passages in the Old Testament where in Deuteronomy and Joshua and other places, God appears to command destruction of men, women and children. Do you want to just pitch the problem here and we'll see what Josh says in return?
Yeah, so the way I see this, when I think through this as a philosopher on one side and then on the other side as a Christian, as a philosopher, it seems to me you would want to avoid killing people just in general. And it seems to me, just thinking through God's motives, God is exceedingly powerful. He can move human beings or keep them from occupying land that he's reserved for other purposes in nonviolent ways, and there's really no reason for God to use what appear to be immoral tactics or even just violent tactics. On the flip side, just as a Christian, I have a difficult time imagining Jesus commanding, you know, the systematic execution of seven-year-olds. Those are very difficult to go together. And it's not just the seven-year-olds dying. It's also using human beings, using Israelites to, in fact, kill the seven-year-olds. And so there would be significant damage on the people actually having to do the violence. And when we look at Jesus just in general, in terms of what Jesus' priorities seem to be in his life, it seems like he is routinely rejecting the land as worthy of devotion. Jesus consistently is rejecting becoming a military-style king or using force. At one point he says, I could call on 12 legions as angels, but I'm not going to do that. And he clearly has the opportunity to use the sorts of tactics used in the Old Testament. And why? Why is it that there's this shift, this change? It seems like Jesus' methods are much better. And so it seems to me this calls into question whether or not the deity that God pictured in some of the Old Testament passages is in fact Jesus. And so I don't know how I wrestle that. I would love good answers on that front.
And as you say, quite honestly there, as a Christian, you wrestle with this. It's not something you've come to terms with in terms of how these can be divinely inspired texts, when you see this disparity, as it would seem, between the way Jesus acts and models his character and what these commands seem to represent in the Old Testament. Okay, Josh, I think that's nicely spelled out the issue. How do you respond to it in the book?
Yeah, definitely. So I think there's two kind of really important great issues that Jeff brought up there. The first being the kind of issue of genocide, kind of the scope of the issue. And then The second being the question of the relation to kind of Jesus, the New Testament, all. And kind of starting with the first one on, is this genocide? And I would actually contest and suggest that it's not. But there's three kind of key angles or observations that I make in the book along the lines where, at first glance, I think as a modern 21st century reader, I'm looking through and some of the commands can seem really pretty brutal, you know. But in context, three observations. First would be that these cities that are spoken of that are kind of dedicated to destruction in the book of Joshua, for example, and the conquest of Canaan are really military cities. So when I hear the word city today, modern 21st century West, I think of a civilian population center, right? So I live in a city and I kind of step outside and I see schools and playgrounds and hospitals and restaurants and the whole kind of civic urban life, you know? But in the ancient world, it was different. And particularly in the Middle East, these cities in, say, the book of Joshua, for example, were these small fortified military outposts that we would think of more as like a military fort. The bulk of the populations lived up in the hills and they looked to the cities as kind of the fortresses for protection from invasion. So Jericho, for example, it's estimated, best estimates with archaeology and other things are that there was likely no more than a few hundred soldiers in there, maybe even as few as 50 to 200. And so I think that kind of confronts this picture that the Israelites are coming in and they're just annihilating civilian population centers. There's more of this picture that they're taking out these fortified military outposts. They're kind of taking down the Great Wall of China, not taking out Beijing that exists there. They're taking on Napoleon and his militias, not Paris and her masses, in a sense. So there is kind of a military context versus a civilian context here. The second observation is what I call ancient trash talk, kind of this idea of the way war rhetoric functioned in the ancient Middle East. There are numerous examples just flooded throughout kind of the way ancient Middle Easterners talked about war, where they used very exaggerated war rhetoric. So this would be similar to, in some ways, for example, like a basketball game today, right? Where you hear, say the team wins and you hear them in the locker room afterwards and they're like, we annihilated them, wiped the floor with them, there was nothing they had on us, like you just killed them, you know? And you would hear it and kind of go, oh, the score was maybe 120-0, something just outrageously, you know, different. But then you find out the actual score was 120-105, let's say. And they did kind of win a decisive victory, but it's nowhere near as dramatic as the language alone would suggest. And that's really the case where you've got these, you know, throughout the ancient Middle East, this language being used of show no mercy, we destroyed them all, there were no survivors, you know, that kind of thing. But then you actually look at the aftermath, and there were, the people were alive and well, the battles kept going, there were still lots of skirmishes left to come. And I think the Bible itself, the Old Testament, shows us that it's doing this, because in a lot of these problematic passages where that language gets used, every time the language is used, and it's only a few spots, all you have to do is go another chapter or a few chapters ahead, and you find that the same enemies that were supposedly annihilated and wiped out are back and are as strong as ever.
Both of those issues you raise there, I think, have also been spelt out in some detail by Paul Copan and Matthew Flanagan and so on, who and other scholars who have recognized, as you say, that there is this apparently exaggerated kind of aspect to some of the genres of literature in the Old Testament, and the fact that these cities were perhaps more like military centers, and so even if there was a command to destroy men, women, and children, it would have been more than likely combatants who were encamped at these places. I suppose it still leaves the question, well, was the command wrong, though, in that sense, even if maybe the reality was a bit different? Was the command to wipe out men, women, and children wrong in itself?
Yeah, so good. When, say that phrase, men, women, and children, when it shows up, it's actually kind of a Hebrew phrase, sort of like heaven and earth, or, you know, where it's a phrase of totality. It speaks to kind of like wipe out the military fort and the totality of everyone inside who doesn't flee or run or get away, right? So, the assumption would be that there weren't any women or children inside, you know? So, on kind of the question you raised of, the Israelites being commanded to kill a 7-year-old Amalekite boy, I think was the imagery being used. For me, part of it is I don't think that probably actually happened, you know, because the 7-year-olds and the mom times, and the grandparents would have been up in the hills looking to the cities for protection. It's interesting, the only actual civilian and only woman who's mentioned is Rahab and all, and in context, scholars believe she was likely a prostitute, you know, who maybe ran the tavern. It was often for kind of the military fortress, you know, and people who maybe visitors that would be coming from out of town. So there's a sense of like the only real men, you know, the only real woman, child, or elderly person that's mentioned is actually spared, which seems significant as well. But the final, maybe third point I just speak to quickly would be that the primary language and imagery that shows up is actually the language of drive out, to drive them out, not kill off. You know, I think the kind of killing them off language only shows up in very few places, but the language of driving them out shows up over 50 times in the Old Testament. So it's really kind of the primary image is that of eviction rather than murder. And I draw attention to some parallels with the imagery of Adam and Eve being exiled, evicted from Eden, being some of the same kind of imagery and language that's being used here, that Canaan, they've kind of been trampling God's garden for so long, and so now they're being driven out, kind of exiled from the garden.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so these three aspects then of how we might understand these Old Testament passages of warfare, does that help, Jeff, for you to, if you like, ease the problem? I mean, effectively, there are different ways of saying it wasn't actually as bad as it's sometimes painted. This didn't involve women and children, most probably. The command itself, you know, could be interpreted not as meaning specifically men, women and children, but simply everybody in that place, if you like. What do you make of this particular way of seeing things?
Yeah, I thought that Josh's work on the Book of Joshua was really interesting on that front. It doesn't actually scratch where I itch. You brought it up, Justin, that it's the commands themselves are troublesome. And it seems to me, if in a land the size of Canaan, if you're going to take over the land, and I hear Josh's phrasing there, sometimes this is killing. Oftentimes it might be driving people out. Driving people out is still immoral, arguably. However, the passages, the one that really hits me most is in 1 Samuel 15, where it is God speaking, "Do not spare men and women, children and infants." And there is a command that everything be destroyed. And the reason given for destroying the Amalekites in this passage is that their ancestors 400 years ago treated the Hebrews badly when they were coming up out of slavery. And that kind of passage just is troublesome. And I don't know that it's worth defending them. I want to actually applaud people that try and defend them, but there is a point in time where I think it might be good and healthy to just say these are not praiseworthy passages.
Yeah, maybe just a quick thought response, because I definitely think that's one of the few places the Samuel passage that Jeff just mentioned is a difficult passage. It's there and in Joshua are kind of the two main places that shows up. But I also think it's interesting at the end of Joshua, it comes to a description of him having done this, kind of having driven out, destroyed everything, and it says Joshua did this exactly as the Lord had commanded, which I think is interesting because it shows or demonstrates that for the author of the book of Joshua, he understands not only kind of the actions that took place downstream, but actually the original command from God to be this exaggerated war rhetoric, to not be kind of a literal depiction that it's using kind of that ancient language. And so my take would be, yeah, when we get to the passage in Samuel, we see the same things happening. There is that command given, but then we also go a few chapters later. I can't remember the exact chapter in Samuel, but we come a little later, and David is actually running into the same people that Saul supposedly annihilated and wiped out. They're still alive, still as strong as ever. And I think there's a strong case to be made in context that it's a military skirmish versus a civilian massacre.
I guess, but does that answer for you the issue of it being commanded nonetheless, Jeff?
No, I think that it seems to me that unless the translation, I mean, it's an English translation, so maybe they're off, but I mean, the report comes back. I mean, if you read through 1 Samuel 15, the report comes back. Saul says, hey, I did everything you said. And you know, the prophet Samuel sees, no, you kept some of the herds and the king, and apparently carried out all the rest. It's the command. The voice of the Lord is simply a different personality than Jesus Christ. That seems to me the problem.
That's your main problem with it. We're going to take a quick break and we'll come back to this. It's a thorny question today on Unbelievable. The issue of what Jeff calls divinely mandated genocide. Not sure that's the phrase that that Josh goes with, but in his book, The Skeletons in God's Closet, he certainly deals with these passages of Old Testament warfare, along with hell and judgment, and we'll get to that as well in the course of today's program. But Jeff, he's a Christian, but he says, I really struggle with these Old Testament warfare passages. I'm not sure that I can say that they are divinely inspired and praiseworthy texts. I don't see Jesus in them in the same way I see him in the New Testament. So we're going to continue this discussion in a moment's time. Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. Don't forget, you can get in touch too. Email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital. We want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support.
Welcome back to today's program with me, Justin Brierley. And today on the program, we're asking about a topic that we've done before in a couple of ways over the years, but those problematic texts in the Old Testament involving warfare and the apparent command by God to slaughter men, women and children. The what's called divinely mandated genocide, says Jeff Cook, who's one of my guests on the program today. My other guest is Josh Butler, who in his book The Skeletons in God's Closet, The Mercy of Hell, The Surprise of Judgment and The Hope of Holy War, believes that actually we can affirm every part of the Bible as affirming the goodness of God, and that, as he explained in the first part, we need to be very careful when we're dealing with these texts regarding warfare in the Old Testament. They may not be everything that they appear to be at face value when we understand the context and the culture and what was being said at the time. I mean, one of the things, though, that we came to at the end of that last section, Josh, was Jeff simply saying, it just doesn't look at all like Jesus, and this is the problem for him. And I think that gets expressed in various different ways by lots of people who say the God of the Old Testament just look so different, you know, in terms of wrath and anger and so on, to Jesus, who seems to kind of represent a very different face, if you like, to God. How do you go about reconciling these two, if they need to be reconciled, Josh?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's the question. Obviously, Jesus is our first and foremost as, you know, followers of Christ. We're trying to engage that. So that's really the question. Maybe zooming out for me, one of the big paradigm shifts that helped a lot in my engagement was going, I think when we hear the words holy war today, when we think of these kind of ancient battles or whatever, we tend to think of the strong using the gods or God, you know, to justify their conquest of the weak. And one of the things that I think is actually happening in the Old Testament that kind of reframes the violence and what's happening is I found that it's actually the opposite. It's God rising up on behalf of the weak when the tyranny of the strong has been raging for far too long. So it's not kind of the strong using gods to oppress the weak. It's God rising up on behalf of the weak against the tyranny of the strong. And so a few observations there, just going, Egypt and Canaan are both kind of depicted as these ancient imperial powerhouses, kind of the mighty dominant for centuries. They've been building their empires and establishing themselves in the ancient world. And Israel is really depicted as kind of the last and the least, this nation of slaves who've had kind of the boot of empire on their neck for centuries. And God is kind of, I think, arising in sort of eschatological judgment of a sense on the empires of the ancient world. There was this really kind of emphasis of structural judgment on kind of these imperial powerhouses, God driving them out and handing over the land to kind of his homeless, wandering, beat up, broken, bruised, last and least of the nation's slaves. I think in part, God is sending a message to the ancient world to go, this is who I am, this is how I judge. I stand up for the downtrodden, for the outcast, for the exploited, for the last and the least. And a few kind of quick observations on some of the distinction in the Old Testament in kind of the Canaan encounter. One is just that Israel, they have no weapons. You know, we tend to think of them coming in maybe with machine guns or, you know, some of that effect. And in the reality, it's like, it's not like there was a stockpile of AK-47s waiting for them in the desert after they left Egypt. They're really coming out as a nation of slaves, and they're encountering Canaan, who's got chariots and horses and armor, and they've got all the weapons you could imagine. And then the Israel strategies are ridiculous, right? Like, how are we going to take Jericho? We'll march around the walls 10 times, then blow, or 7 times, and blow trumpets. You know, like, we're going to make music. It's really ridiculous battle strategy. You can imagine the, you know, allied soldiers storming the beaches of Normandy with, instead of weapons, you know, with musical instruments, with guitars or something, you know, and like it would just be a slaughter. There's a ridiculousness to the battle strategy. So I try and trace in the book how it's not the exception, but it's the norm. Pretty much all of the battle strategies look kind of ridiculous. And I think they're designed to show that God is the one who's really leading the charge and fighting on behalf of his sort of weak and exploited, beleaguered people against kind of the ancient empires of the world. Israel's got no chance unless God's the one leading the charge. And finally, a final point I make was just with ideology going, I think we tend to justify the wars we wage by pointing to how great our civilization is, right? So the Roman Empire, you know, like the Pax Romana, we're bringing this peace in the wake of the fighting, and it justifies our wars. Today, I think there'd be a sense of, well, we've got Coca-Cola and computers and compact cars, kind of, we're bringing democracy and freedom. We'll use what we perceive to be the greatness of our civilization to justify our warfare. But the Old Testament, again, flips it, and it's exactly the opposite. Israel seems to constantly be boasting in just that she's disobedient, she's rebellious, she's idolatrous, you know, and it's almost like Israel hired a reporter to walk around and track all of her biggest mistakes and shortcomings and weaknesses and to blast them all over their own history books, you know. So victors usually write the history books. Israel looks like she got the enemy to write hers, you know. So there's this, so all that to say, it doesn't necessarily, violence is still a tricky topic today. It doesn't necessarily solve it, and I have some thoughts on that, but I do think it starts to reframe the type of violence that we see happening, you know, that it's, it starts to present a different picture, I think, than the...
Yeah, if it's the underdog, the oppressed, the marginalized who are kind of rising up in that sense. Jeff, I don't know if any of this helps for you. I know that violence generally is an issue for you when it comes to whether God would sanction violence, full stop, in a way. But yeah, just a response to Josh there.
I thought that was some of the stronger points that, Josh made in the book, and I thought that that was really worthwhile. I thought it was praiseworthy. I would gladly trade, you know, America's defense strategy for, you know, picking up musical instruments and marching around our enemies' fortresses instead of what we presently tend to do. So I actually think that's really a mark. That's a step forward. May not get all the way there, but I do think that that's a step forward. I am convinced that Jesus thinks that violence doesn't solve problems ever. I'm convinced that the rest of the New Testament writers are going to agree, and I think Revelation, for example, is going to really highlight how Christians, the most powerful weapon that we have is our own suffering. And I think God, being all-knowing, knows this, and that's why when saying that the Old Testament is inspired, I would love to elevate some of the passages that Josh is highlighting and saying, this is beautiful, this is praiseworthy, these are things that do seem to flow from the Spirit of God. I do want to say that there's another voice going on in the Old Testament, and sometimes it's very difficult to reconcile those voices. And maybe it's a dialogue within Israel saying, what kind of people are we going to be, or what kind of God are we going to serve? Maybe what's inspired is a dialogue as opposed to a monologue. Those are ways I try and wrestle with this, but at the end of the day, it seems to me there is some awful material still, you know, in the Old Testament, even though there is some very, very praiseworthy stuff, like Josh is highlighting.
I mean, do you feel in that sense, Jeff, that Jesus, I mean, what do you think Jesus would say about those passages in the Old Testament?
Well, and I haven't done a ton of study on this, but I know that Jesus skips a lot of material. He'll be quoting a passage out of Isaiah, for example, and there'll be something about destroying your enemies, and he'll skip right over it and then keep going. And so there is a worthy study of noticing the things that Jesus passes over as though they're unworthy of being said, or perhaps he's saying, you know what, this isn't where our kingdom's going to go. And it's worth even saying, you know, in the Sermon on the Mount begins with him revising and improving upon what Moses has handed down. And so it's not unseemly to say, hey, this, the Old Testament doesn't go far enough.
So when Jesus says, it was said unto you, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, love your enemies, forgive those who persecute you, and so on. He effectively, you believe, is revising, if you like, the Old Testament, you know, position, if you like, on warfare and violence and so on.
I think he's radically reshaping the ethic. I am an ethicist. He is trading up Moses' deontological position for his own virtue ethical position. He is saying the rules don't matter anymore. What matters is the good heart, for out of the good tree, you know, a good tree will always produce good fruit. And so nearly everything you see in terms of Jesus' ethic, and this is adopted by Paul, ends up focusing on character formation, on the sort of person you are and not the sorts of things that you do. Now, that's just one revision, but I imagine that when Jesus says things later in Matthew 5 about God, how God's love is communicated to humanity, sending the rain on the righteous and the unrighteous, and the sunshine on the righteous and unrighteous, that is the heart of the Father for all human beings. And that would be another example of something very difficult to square with, hey, this is our land, let's take it, these guys don't matter.
So for you then, Jeff, whatever the Old Testament is, whatever is happening in these stories in the Old Testament, it's got to be in some way an impartial, imperfect picture of the character of God when it comes to those commands about attacking and warfare and so on, because Jesus, if he is the perfect picture of God, radically gives a radically different idea on those issues.
Yeah, I think our reading of the Old Testament needs to come with cross-shaped glasses and we need to be able to exclude things that simply do not conform to the character and personality of Jesus, or at least set them aside for a moment and just say, look, we don't understand this yet. We'll get to it later. But for now, this is just off the table.
It's an interesting approach. Josh, do you think that's a valid way of treating the Old Testament, say, if it doesn't conform with what with how we understand God through Jesus Christ, we set it aside, or at least say we're not going to deal with that at this point?
Yeah, well, I definitely understand the tension. I think I would probably tend to take a little bit of a different approach. So, for example, if we take the passage, the eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, I see not so much a radical reshaping or discontinuity as much as Jesus deepening kind of the Old Testament. So I was struck reading the early church fathers back in the day and being struck how a number of them, when they talk about that passage, the way they saw what Jesus was doing was in the Old Testament context with Moses, eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, it wasn't like, hey, if someone takes your eye, go take theirs too. It was more like, dude, if someone pokes out your eye, you want to slit their throat and take their life. So there's a sense of it's restraining. We want to, and that's how this kind of cycle of violence kind of spirals out of proportion. You know, you take my sheep, I go take your cows, and then you set my barn on fire, and then the, you know, families are at war for generations. And so it's going, if someone, you know, I think the sense of the Mosaic law, in my understanding there, is going, if someone does something to you, you're not allowed to do more than what they took, which is what you want to do. You know, so there's sort of a restraint on our violent impulses. And so what I see Jesus doing is not necessarily annihilating, you know, abolishing the heart of that law as much as he's deepening it, going, I'm taking the restraint even further. Like, not only can you not get that back, you're going to move towards forgiveness and not non-retaliation. And so I tend to in many areas see Jesus in the New Testament deepening the heart of the old rather than radically overthrowing it, if that makes sense.
Is this in some sense a kind of form of progressive revelation at some level that if you like, God moves at the pace of where people are at in their culture and time, and Jesus, at the point we get to Jesus, they're ready to hear a kind of a radically different kind of way of treating your neighbor, even as much as the Old Testament had sort of moved people on at least a little bit from where they were.
Yes, yeah. So there's sort of a trajectory, even in the Old Testament, of non-retaliation to an extent, but I do think even in the New that there is at least I suggest or would make the case that there is a legitimacy. There's a distinction I think that is assumed between kind of personal identity and sort of institutional or governmental identity, that Moses is able to give the command, thou shalt not, you know, murder, but then is able to partake in, as a governor, you know, is able to partake in killing immediately thereafter. And it's not seen in as a contradiction. And I think that's kind of most societies throughout history have kind of seen that distinction. The police are allowed to do something that I, as a citizen, am not, you know, and where I kind of go with that is to make a distinction between, I think Jeff is right. I don't think violence accomplishes things if what we're talking about accomplishing is kind of redemption. There's sort of many will critique kind of the myth of redemptive violence. And I would say, I don't believe violence is redemptive, but I do think it can be preservative. And I think in the kind of mature, kind of robust, much of the historic Christian tradition would say there's a role that government has in utilizing the sword to kind of put a restraint on evil, to sort of preserve the shalom and flourishing of society. And governmental violence doesn't redeem, it doesn't bring redemption, but it can restrain. So an example, I went on a police ride along years ago, and we stopped to get a drink at a little convenience store. And as we walked in, there was an immigrant family that owned the store, and kind of an old elderly man. And he ran out from behind the counter, ran up and gave the police officer a hug. And I was kind of shocked, like, what's going on here? Why is this man giving the police officer a hug? And I asked him, he said, well, you know, for a while, you know, we were getting robbed like a couple times a week. I felt afraid for our life, for my wife's life. We called the police, no one would come. And then eventually this police officer began to show up regularly, and just his presence as someone that kind of wielded the sword, so to speak, you know, incited fear. And he's like, like, we haven't been robbed in a couple months now. And he's like, I just feel like there's a safety there. And so that spoke to me of what I think is kind of going on in Romans 13, this idea that I don't believe governmental violence is redemptive. I can't reestablish shalom. But I do think there's a place that it can put a restraint on sin.
Let's allow Jeff a little time then to dig into this. You can respond to that, Jeff. You can talk as well, I guess, about your own view. I'm kind of getting the sense that you're a pacifist at some level when it comes to your view of what are the Christian approach to violence as far as we see it in Jesus.
Yeah, I am. I think Paul says that love never fails. That's a universal claim. That you can't possibly imagine a situation in which love will not accomplish God's best and will. And it seems to me that violence is really difficult to square with a posture of love. And the effectiveness of Jesus' cross ends up being the paradigmatic, you know, way of seeing how we ought to confront the evil in our world. I am okay in the idea of preservative, perhaps I would want to call it restraint. I mean, like physical force that's focused on restraining those who are wicked. But obviously, I think that must be wed with wisdom. And it seems to me the Christian community at our best needs to showcase the brilliance of how taking on suffering ourselves actually affects and redeems the world around us.
But in a sense, then, do you see that there's any case for saying that there was this, if you like, in a sense, progression? The Old Testament, even those laws that Jesus revised, if you like, they right. for their time were to some extent creating an answer to a problem, which was a cycle of violence, and saying no, we're going to, it's an eye for an eye, not an eye and a tooth for an eye or whatever.
I think that so again, I'm an ethicist on this, right? I would Moses is a lot like Aristotle in terms of their view of Aristotle's view of physics is really ancient and basic. Newton comes along, and Aristotle isn't wrong on some fronts, but Newton makes a whole lot more sense. And there's a paradigm shift. There's a complete trading up of philosophies at work. I would reject the progressive revelation. What happens is there's an absolutely new ethical theory that Jesus is advocating. It is the case that Moses is great in terms of creating an ancient society based on rules. Jesus rejects the rules. Paul rejects the rules. In fact, they showcase the places that rules actually are dehumanizing if you focus on a rule-based ethic. It is about character and becoming, being made into the image of God. That is what's most vital to the ethical life.
Be interested in hearing from you, Josh, as we get towards the end of this second part of the program. We haven't talked yet about judgment and hell, which are other aspects covered in the book. What's the overall paradigm that you're trying to picture in here about these issues, which, as you say, are often there's often a popular caricature about these issues. You know, hell is this medieval torture chamber, judgment is God being mean, basically, and holy war is genocide and so on. But what is your kind of overall, what if someone was reading this book, what would you want them to take away in terms of the big picture of God and what's going on with these issues?
Yeah, that's great. I think, you know, one of the big things I found, if we start with hell, for example, is that I think the overarching story I think most folks have is kind of the sense of, like, right now I live on earth, when am I going to die, and God's either going to send me up to heaven or down to hell. And so hell starts to become kind of this underground torture chamber, and it makes God look vindictive and all. But I really don't think that's the biblical story at all. I think the biblical story is not God being on a mission to get us out of earth and into heaven or hell, I would suggest the biblical story is God's on a mission to reconcile heaven and earth from the destructive power of hell. There's a sense that God has created a good heavens and a good earth, good creation, but in the biblical story, heaven and earth are torn apart by the destructive power of sin, that our sin kind of unleashes this destructive power into the world. But God's good, so he's on this mission in and through Christ to reconcile heaven and earth, to bring creation back to himself. And so then, he's reconciling it from the destructive power of sin, death, and hell. And in this story, I think we start to see it arise from the goodness of God, like actually to be something that comes from his goodness rather than kind of this vindictive mean-spiritedness. And it's God's good purposes for his world, but it does face us with this kind of tension or challenge because we in many ways have set ourselves in opposition to God's goodness and God's good purposes for the world. So we're kind of placed in this place of going, are we going to receive God's mercy and be restored and reconciled and healed? Or do we kind of want to resist and cling to our idols, our independence, our autonomy, and not be made fit for the kingdom? And so that's kind of the paradigm shift there, I'd say, at the biggest level, is seeing it arising out of from the goodness of God, from his desire to reconcile heaven and earth.
Yeah.
And maybe this, yeah, I could stop there and if we wanted
let's get a bit of in from Jeff on this. I mean, you said at the outset, Jeff, that you did appreciate the way that Josh, for instance, tackles the issue of hell, even though you do take a different perspective. You're an annihilationist, and I think Josh ultimately defends still a sort of an eternal aspect to the nature of hell. Do you want to just speak into what Josh said there?
Both Josh and I both use almost identical arguments about hell, and when we come to the conclusion, we both go different ways. I think that the things that I appreciated most in his book and the things that I was learning was that he was picturing the nature of evil as a force that unravels, that evil itself, evil, hell, sin, death, these should be almost, I took it that these are synonymous in some ways, that it is a power at work. In my first book, Seven, which is on the deadly sins and the Beatitudes, I go into that in terms of the nature of sin, that is a power as opposed to the description of just acts. We should think about sin that way. But hell, if you die and are separated from God, who is the source of life, and given to the power of sin, what will that unconscious power do to you aside from tear you apart? And so that would be my conclusion. Josh's was more, and he could go into this, is more about containment. But I don't know why God would create that sphere or where that sphere exists. Or I would need to know more about the ontology of how hell as an entity actually continues to exist in an everlasting way. That's something I would want
to
answer.
Yeah, Josh. What it's interesting to hear Jeff say we go almost exactly together until the end, when you see in the end the solution, if you like, to the issue of sin and evil, and rebellion being an eternal place of whatever it is, regret and rebellion. Whereas for Jeff, obviously, the natural conclusion is simply a final end, and being cut off from God means you're cut off from existence effectively. What's made you kind of still nonetheless take the traditional perspective, at least on this?
Yeah, definitely. And I should say, I do think that there are some strong biblical arguments and things that can be made for the annihilationist or, conditional mortality perspective. But I do land in the more traditional camp. And a few thoughts just on that part would be, first off, I think the resurrection of Christ is kind of central for me. I think that in Christ's resurrection, what he is accomplishing is his victory over sin, death, and the grave. And there's a sense that for annihilationism, there's a sense of I don't think we can go back into the grave anymore because Christ has conquered it, in a sense, you know. So one of the arguments, suggestions I make is that I think it would minimize the scope and power of Christ's resurrection, that actually, even if we would want to, we can't necessarily go back into the dust. And that's actually a part of God's mercy towards us all, that he would raise all, not just the good but the wicked as well, in the sense that there's the resurrection sort of lays a claim on all. But another argument I make is that I would actually suggest that often, and not always, but I think often, at least on a popular level, that when I see people going for annihilationism, I think it's often because they're responding to a caricature of hell as torture. You know, it's kind of like the torture chamber just looks awful and just put them out of their misery kind of thing, right? You know, but I really try to make a strong case that the traditional view is just, it's not torture. There is torment, and I think that's a very different thing from torture, though. And so when we have, I think, a more robust picture in place, I would actually suggest that to annihilate the unrepentant sinner is more cruel than to allow them to live on in kind of their self-inflicted predicament, if you will. So
it's an interesting perspective. Let's take a quick break there, and we're going to start to wrap things up in the next section of the program. Today we're discussing the skeletons in God's closet. My guests are Josh Butler and Jeff Cook. I'm Justin Briley. This is Unbelievable. Time of the week here on Premier Christian Radio, when we help you think through big issues. And today's has certainly been big issues, hell and genocide in the Old Testament. Not small ones that we're tackling today, but I hope you can stay with us through to the third part of today's programme. Okay, we're wrapping up our discussion on the skeletons in God's closet. The person bringing them out into the open has been Josh Butler, who's a church leader, but in his book he talks about hell, judgment and holy war, and says that we don't need to, as it were, see these as deficiencies in God's character somehow, but that when we rightly understand them, we will see that all of Scripture points to the goodness of God. And we've talked certainly at length at the beginning of today's program about issues around holy war, passages in Scripture on warfare, what Jeff Cook, my other guest, describes as divinely mandated genocide, and says he simply can't in the end reconcile with the person of Jesus Christ. And so we've had some interesting discussions around that. We talked about hell as well a little bit, and we will mention judgment as well, which I think is important. If you want to find out more about both of my guests, books and so on, Josh is at joshuaryanbutler.com. And as we've mentioned, his book is The Skeletons in God's Closet. Jeff can be found at everythingnew.org. His books that he's published and came on to talk about a couple of years ago, actually, was Everything New and his book Seven. So go and look those up. Links, of course, from today's programme as well online. Jeff, you wanted to respond just briefly to what Josh had to say about why the resurrection of Christ at some level means that for him annihilation isn't the best way of seeing God's the way God will finally judge those who rebel, if you like. What were your thoughts on that?
I agree that resurrection is the defeat of Hades. It is not the defeat of Gehenna, or what is later called the lake of fire. Hades gets thrown into the lake of fire alongside the souls of the damned, as well as the satanic forces. And so that is the image of destruction of all things that will not conform to the new creation, because God's going to be God of everything. He's making everything new. He will be all in all. In terms of mercy being shown through eternal punishment as opposed to annihilation, I mean, this is a value judgment, I suppose. In Genesis 3, we see Adam and Eve getting kicked out of the garden, and God says he will not allow them to stay in the garden because they would, in their sinful condition, eat from the tree of life and live forever. And apparently God thinks that living forever under the reign of sin would be very, very bad. And so mercy for God in Genesis 3 is allowing Adam and Eve to return to the dust, as it were, to be annihilated. In my mind and heart, that actually is the merciful step. If I had to choose one of my sons either going on indefinitely for trillions upon trillions of years under the reign of sin, or to allow a merciful God to end their lives, I would choose ending their lives. And it seems to me most of the metaphors Jesus uses in his parables point to exactly that.
Quick response, Josh.
Yeah, no, it's great. I think that the book goes into a lot more of kind of my theological arguments or whatever, but I think where I'd maybe go here would just be a thought. If the gospel is like a marriage proposal of God going, I want to be in union with you, want to be united with you, live life together forever with you, it seems to me that the marriage proposal of annihilationism kind of comes down to going, marry me or I'll kill you. You know, like, be united with me or I'm going to snuff you out. Whereas the gospel, as I see it, is more of a kind of marry me or go your own way. Like I want to be bound in union with you. I want to be in life with you, but if you prefer your autonomy, I'll create, in a sense, a space for that. Even though life apart from God is, in my estimation, why would you want that? You know, I think I would just kind of maybe land there for now.
In a sense, then you're saying that the eternal aspect of giving people a place where they pursue their own rebellion. Is it more consistent with giving them their freedom than if it were cutting them off in that sense?
Yeah, I see it as a more merciful option. Yeah, I use an analogy in the book. There's a chapter towards the end of the hell section on hell is democracy, hell is the suburbs, and hell is Facebook. You know, looking at these ways that kind of in our own collective life today that we actually prefer democracy, we prefer freedom from God. Suburbs, we prefer freedom from each other. Facebook, we prefer a sense of freedom from ourselves. And I think there's a sense where we see the logic of hell playing out around us. And there's something to me when you get kind of tangible and practical like that to go, I'm going to pull out a gun and go shoot the dude on Facebook and his computer out in the suburbs, you know, like because I think his life looks so pathetic or something, you know, like that starts to feel kind of condescending and harsh, you know. But so a part of it, I feel like it's the abstraction of the way at times we talk about it so much in the abstract that it starts to be easier to think of kind of killing folks off. But I think we kind of get down to the nitty gritty of if that was my neighbor, you know, 100, 500 years from now, would I want to go over there with a gun and take him out? The traditional view seems to me to be more of a merciful, kind of consistent with the character of God.
Mm. Well, we don't have time to probably unpack that any further, really, at this point. But I understand, Jeff, that from your perspective, the view of annihilation, conditional immortality, seems to make more sense for you of the most merciful way to deal with people who do reject God ultimately. There was at least one area where you said, Jeff, I think that you were more or less in full agreement with Josh on this book, and it's the third aspect, which we haven't really had time to cover at any depth, but judgment. Do you want to just explain why you felt you were perfectly happy to go along with the way Josh approaches that particular issue?
Yeah, things in our world need to be judged by a all-knowing, supremely good God. It's a good thing for God to judge child abuse. It's a good thing for God to judge violence and warfare. It's a good thing for God to judge the things in my heart in life that need to be repaired. Judgment is what we see in a doctor's office when a doctor looks at us and says, this is where you're unhealthy. And being able to surrender ourselves and our will to Christ and the Spirit's repair of our lives is one of the great hopes that we have in Christ.
I suppose the problem is in the popular culture, Josh, a lot of people, when they hear the word judgment, what they actually hear is judgmental and the idea that God is somehow basically being a sort of hardline oppressor by sort of laying down some kind of, you know, judgmental rule. But that's not obviously the way that you see what judgment, actually taken correctly from Scripture, should be.
Yeah, definitely. I think exclusivity is another way of putting the challenge today that folks, when they hear of judgment, kind of final judgment, there's this caricature, I think, often of people who go to church are in and everyone else is out, you know, and it's like, God, that seems kind of closed-minded or harsh, you know, but I think the biblical picture, I argue, especially through Jesus's parables, but in scripture as a whole, is more of one of surprise. I suggest the chief characteristic of judgment in Jesus's teaching and in scripture as a whole is that when God shows up to judge, the results are a shocking surprise. You know, it's kind of shock and awe. There's a sense that God shows up and he weeds out from within his people. He kind of weeds out the hypocrisy and the junk that's not really of him. And he gathers in from outside of his people. He gathers in kind of the multitudes and the nations come streaming into the kingdom feast. And so it's not universalism because there is a weeding out and it's not everyone that comes in, but there is a more nuanced picture, a more robust picture. And as we look into why God judges, I don't think scripture gives us a clear picture of who's in and who's out in terms of my neighbor or, you know, particular details, but I think it tells us who the judge is, that the judge is Jesus. He's a good judge. He's better than we are. And that his judgment is good news for the world because it comes from God's love and his desire to set his world right from the destructive things that tear it apart.
In a sense, then, Jeff, judgment, you could equally use the word perhaps justice for that. It's God setting things right and you know, putting the scales back into balance, if you like.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Justice is the target that God is aiming at in terms of God's judgments. And I love Josh's phrase there, that we don't need to have all the standards laid out because we're not the judge. And it's actually very bad when Christians put themselves in the position of judge because we're pushing Christ out of the way and saying we can do this better than you. And our job is to be fully committed to loving others because Christ has given his life for their sake, and it's a good thing for us to get rid of our own judgmentalism because God's much, much better at that job than we are.
If you don't mind me saying, Jeff, it sounds like, and because I know of his writings and speaking quite well, Greg Boyd in many of the things you're saying, has he been an influence in your thinking in terms of both annihilation and, you know, your view on violence and that kind of thing?
Yeah, I've loved, if you haven't, Greg Boyd's podcast is one of the best things out there right now. Your show and his are the two I listen to, but he's fantastic on these fronts, and I think does present what is a healthy perspective. I think we need to repaint Christianity in the minds of many of our neighbors, and I think the way that he is painting it is a very healthy perspective and worthy of adoption.
What about you, Josh? You don't have to sort of, you know, pick on anyone in particular, but in terms of trying to reframe Christianity in terms of these issues, do you think there are any other commentators out there who you're finding particularly helpful at the moment or who have influenced you when you've come to write this book?
Yeah, you know, a few, N.T. Wright has been a big influence, as for many I know. I really love some folks like Miroslav Volf, Nicholas Wolterstorff is someone who's influenced some of the work there, and Oliver O'Donovan was a big one, and Colin Gunton, William Kavanaugh is a favorite. But especially for me too, I think I love kind of digging back into church history. Augustine is a major influence in the book. Definitely drawn C.S. Lewis, he's brilliant as always, and some of the early church fathers like Irenaeus. It just feels like there's a whole treasure trove of riches there within the tradition to dive into.
Well, look, it's been really interesting, and I'm so glad we were able to arrange today's program, which came together as they sometimes do in very quick order and at a late stage in planning. But it was good to have you both on and to just take some time to walk through these issues and hear both of your perspectives on this. It's certainly been really informative for me, and I'm sure for many people listening. So, Jeff,
thank
and
you
Josh,
so much. I've loved it.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff, as well for being on with us.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
And once more, if you want to find out more about both my guests today, well, links from today's program online, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on today's program and there'll be links to Jeff and Josh and where you can find their books. But if you're just searching joshuaryanbutler.com for Josh and everythingnew.org for Jeff. Guys, thanks very much and all the best. And I'm sure we'll be in touch again at a later point.
Yeah,
thank you.
Course.
Thank you for listening to this week's Classic Replay. Do let us know what you thought. You can email us at unbelievable@premier.org.uk or leave a comment on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/premierunbelievable, or tweet us at unbelievablefe. For more resources for exploring faith, head over to our website, premierunbelievable.com, and if you register there, you'll unlock access to all the content on the website, and we'll send you updates and exclusive content through the Premier Unbelievable newsletter, including bonus videos and ebooks. That's premierunbelievable.com. See you next time for another classic replay of Unbelievable.